dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, for your edification during the holiday season, a collection of tales of horror, some real, some fictional. The real tales are testimonies of people in New York, Pennsylvania, and Colorado whose homes and lives have been destroyed so that energy corporations can make profits for their shareholders, extracting gas to fuel the orgy of consumption and waste that is proudly called by some our way of life, but that is leading inexorably towards our way of death. Our fictional horror stories are readings of works by Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and H.P. Lovecraft. All of them deal with consequences. For New York listeners, we have only 3 more days till the deadline closes to pressure Governor Patterson to set aside his draft environmental impact statement that would give the gas drillers license to destroy the Finger Lakes, the Southern Tier, and the Catskills, as they have already destroyed parts of Pennsylvania and Colorado. If you've not done so already, contact the governor by phone and email. The phone number is in your phone book, and you can send an email through a link at toxicstargeting.com, where you can also read and sign the coalition letter to the governor. The goal is to submit 10,000 signatures of individuals and organizations. I'm pleased to report that my congressional representative, Eric Massa, is right at the top of the list of signers. It's a rare and wonderful feeling to actually feel represented by a representative. Our first piece of testimony comes from Ron Gulla, a farmer in Pennsylvania who was interviewed by George Sapio and Maura Stevens.
They know exactly what they're doing. They know how to rook people. They know how to shaft people. They're professionals at it. That's what they do. You know, you try to trust somebody, you can't trust them. That's it. You cannot trust them. Bottom line, no way, shape, or form can you trust these people. The hell they've put me through, and me and my family, and other people around here, it's disgusting. People don't sleep at night. People are so upset that they were so stupid that they signed a lease. You know, that now they beat themselves up, just like I have. But I was lied to about on the lease, too. They totally misrepresented the lease. Every question that I asked, they didn't give me the right answer. All they want is your signature. And as soon as you sign, they got you. Now, do you think if I would have known that I'm going to jeopardize my property, my life, my family's life, with chemicals all over my property? No way, shape, or form. The lies just add up. The building that they have built, the foundation that they have built to try to make the public believe in them, it is so weak, it's unbelievable. And people that are finally catching on know that. There are no equal scales of justice here, period. This is all sided to the industry. That's why they got the Pennsylvania Oil and Gas Act put through. You do not stand a chance. That legislation is all for them. Not for the community, not for the landowner. It's all for them.
You know, you had a dream that you wanted to create, and once they're done with you, it just goes right up in smoke pretty quick. And there's nothing you could do, and they're just arrogant about it. That's what really ticks you off. Garbage around here. There's garbage. You can still find pieces. I've cleaned so much of it up. But guys will throw whatever they're drinking or eating.
And they claim that they put everything back better than original. No, they don't.
No one drinks their water around here.
No.
People buy bottled water. We've been told a lot of things. There's so many stories out there, it's unbelievable. They definitely took the pristineness out of this area. There's no question about it. And you don't know who's in here from one day to the next. Every day there's somebody in here different. And that's the sad part, because you just don't know who's driving into your property. This road was one way in, one way out, and no one ever came in here. And if they did come in here, you know, they may have made a wrong turn or whatever. They were looking for someone, but nah, you just don't know who's on your property.
It's creepy.
And I don't like it. I absolutely hate it. You know, I didn't buy this place to have a ton of different people coming on here that I don't know them. I don't know their history. I don't know anything about them. And I've farmed my, you know, from the time I was a little kid. Both my grandparents had farms, and I had five different relatives that had farms. So I grew up with a farming background. So, you know, I didn't buy this just to have it as a summer home. I mean, I was going to make this into an operation. I wanted to put a peach orchard up in here, about 5 acres of peaches. This pond, I wanted to start to sell the fish out of the pond. I wanted to see if I could get certified to sell the fish to people for, you know, their ponds. Because I have like 7 different species in here. But there were a number of things that I wanted to do, and, you know, I can't do it now. And I, when I did raise my cattle and I sold them as, and I promoted them as organically grown. Mm. So, you know, you can't trust anything here now. There have been water wells at some of the farms contaminated. But now you've got people out there that are victims, and they're coming out and they're talking. And they just had a meeting Thursday night up at Gander Mountain. This was the first meeting that people were really outraged of what's going on. And my buddy came in here, and he was fishing with his daughter. He said, Ronnie, he said, all the vegetation in there is dead. Every bit of it was dead. And then the pond turned a copper color. And now that is very familiar, because every place so far that has been contaminated, every stream, said it's a rust color. Well, mine turned into a copper color. Copper, rust, same color. No, because the DEP is in bed with the industry. It is so obvious what's going on. They do not help the public here at all. It's a joke. I did a file review about a month ago on my property just to see what they have in my file. They had nothing in here about my pond whatsoever. And the guy that was calling on me at that time was out here with a digital camera. Well, there's definitely a problem here, Ron. There's definitely a problem. Yeah, there is a problem, Mark. Well, what are you going to do about it? Well, we don't know where it's come from. Hey, Mark, there are the well sites right up there. All the mud and slop was running right down into my pond. I complained and I complained. There was mud back there 2 feet deep. And I had silt in the back of the pond, running into the pond, mud and silt coming off that hill. It was over a foot thick. But now he works for Range Resources. And when I did my file review, he also told me, Ron, your farm, and I will never forget this, it's embedded in the back of my brain, Ron, your farm is a textbook case of what not to do. It's a textbook case of what not to do. It's outrageous. And when you find out, and you start doing your homework on all the political contributions that are taking place here with our state reps, and commissioners, and, I mean, you just name it, every politician is just getting their pockets lined. They're all thieves. As far as I'm concerned, I can't be devious that way. I like to sleep at night. And a lot of people said, well, why, you know, why have you done what you've done? Why didn't you just, you know, walk away from this? Because if I would have walked away from this and people would have gotten sick, then I would have felt like it was my fault that I didn't step up. And I was raised, if there's something wrong, you bring it to people's attention. And when you're a steward of the land, and you have a farm, you know when there are problems. As I've told many people, a farm is just like raising a child. You know, you nurture it, you know, you take care of it, you do a lot of things to it, and when there's something that's out of place on it, you know it. You know there's something wrong. And there were so many problems here, it was incredible. And I just said, I'm taking it upon myself that I'm going to keep talking, and I don't care. I'm not going to stop. These people need to be stopped. And if it's a benign process, why in God's green earth in 05 did you get the federal exemptions put into place? Why did Cheney do what he did? Why? Because they know that it's not safe. They know that. They know that going into this. But that's what they can do because they've got the money and the power.
And
we're nobody.
What if you had cancer or your kids got cancer?
Well, that's too late. What are you going to do about it? That's my problem.
They would do something about it?
No, that's my problem. Then prove it. As the attorneys, well, prove it. Prove it. I mean, I had my belly full of attorneys, trust me. I know how rotten these attorneys are and what they try to do to me here. It's disgusting. And it's absolutely scary is what it is, because you can't trust them. It's pathetic. Some people think this is the greatest thing. But again, they could be washing, drinking, bathing in polluted water, and they don't even know it. And we've gone around and we've told people, you have to be cautious, you have to keep your eyes open, you have to stay aware. Some people are receptive, some people are like, we really don't want to hear it. They don't tell you anything. They're supposed to inform you, it tells you on a lease, they're supposed to inform you for everything that they do. They don't inform you. I said, this is bull. Because they broke their lease numerous times. And they used this place as a supply yard or a stock yard. I mean, they stocked their equipment in here. They left equipment in here for months at a time. It was like it's their place. And that's just how that's just how you feel. It's their land. It's not your land anymore. They know the game, and they're in here to do one thing, and that's make the shareholders and make them wealthy, and the chairmen of the board and everyone else involved. It's terrible. The stress of this is phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. There are farmers here that I talk to that don't sleep at night. They wake up 2-3 o'clock in the morning. They're miserable about what they've done, because now they know their land is done. They can't sell this land now. If once this was a hot area, people wanted to move to and put horse farms in and stuff like that. But now, what would you do with it? You can't subdivide it. I got gas lines. I got 4 gas lines running right down through the middle of this, right up through the middle of my property. I got a big gas well back there. You know, you got the gas well up in that field. People don't want to see this stuff. You know, when they buy a piece of property, they want the peace and quiet. They don't want to see tanker trucks coming in here every week pulling out brine water or pulling out drip gas that goes to the refineries. You want some seclusion, privacy, and that's all gone. But really, and again, what really ticks you off, you know, and they don't respect the land like you do. They have one thing on their agenda, and that's to get that hole in the ground. I've cleared roughly 80 acres here, but it was all in vain. The spin that they use now is, well, we're preserving the land out here for you. You don't have to worry about housing developments coming in or malls. That's the spin they're putting on it now. They put a spin on everything that they do, every problem that they create, they put a spin on it. Now is the right time to do it because they're exempt from everything. You couldn't do this if you weren't exempt. Clean air, clean water, safe drinking water, right to know, Superfund Act. So if it's a benign process, why would you be exempt from all these things? If it's an up and up business and they're a stand up company and the industry is being upfront with all the landowners, they're not. They're not looking out for your best interest. They're looking out for their best interest. Who knows what comes out of these wells anyway, other than them? No one knows. These folks get a royalty check. Well, God bless them, but they don't know the truth. They're not regulated. Who regulates them? I always thought they were regulated. I didn't know any better. I'm thinking, well, a couple vertical wells, no big deal. They're small tanks, you know, a couple little roads. Oh, well, free gas. No one told me anything about the exemptions. No one told me about the chemicals. No one told me that they were going to put chemicals up on these well sites that'll be there for the life of that well with placards on them, hazardous placards on them. And that doesn't get into the water table? Right. Over time, you know it does. It has to.
And then they say nothing pollutes the water wells, nothing pollutes the aquifer. Come on, how many people in every state has been a victim? And they try to keep covering it up and covering it up. I mean, they keep talking about our independence. We're going to be independent. We're not going to be independent. We're selling it. We want to sell it. That's what they, we want to be the biggest exporter. That's what Range Resources said last year on Channel 2 News. We could be the largest exporter. Well, wait a minute. What happened to us being independent? You go to do a file review. It's amazing how they don't put anything in the files that actually what actually happened. And these are our tax dollars hard at work, protecting our environment and the people. But as long as they're exempt from everything, who cares? And you think this doesn't get into our rivers? It goes into the streams, into our aquifers, and floats right into our rivers. Everybody's drinking it. No matter if you live in a country and you have city water, if you live in a city and you're drinking city water. We're all affected by this, every last one of us. But they're putting a pipeline in through here. They brought in two pipelines from the neighbors because the neighbors, they got a horizontal up there. And I think they did a ton of how many wells off of that pad. And they brought the lines through my property so they could connect into the, you know, up to the main, I guess, main transmission line. But when they came through here, they dug this out and, you know, they took more trees out. They knocked a lot of trees out up on top. No one counted them, nothing. They just do what they want. You know, they didn't sit down with me and say, hey, this is what we're going to do. They're coming through. And they come through. Any problem I had, I'm complaining and nothing was getting done. They just, you know, it's like they give you this song and dance. Well, yeah, there's a problem, but we don't know. You know, there's really nothing we could do. Or just like when I said about my pond, well, yeah, there's something in there, but we don't know how it got in there. What do you mean you don't know how it got in there? Come on. This is so full of common sense, it's incredible. Don't insult my intelligence. I mean, you people have insulted me enough. The biggest mistake that I ever made was trusting anybody. Now I don't trust anybody. And people will tell you that around here. A lot of these folks that have been burnt don't trust anybody. And they weren't that way before. Now it's like, you know, you're skeptical about everything, and you think someone's always going to stab you in the back. Now it's terrible. It's a terrible way to think. It's a terrible way to have to live. But that's how you become. You become so calloused from it all, cynical. You do, because you trusted, and that's the worst thing you could do. You can't trust. Not with these guys. When it comes to energy, you don't trust. They did all this under the radar. No one knew. They took us completely by surprise. And that was their game plan, because they operate like the military. And they use military tactics because they divide and conquer. And they do divide the communities. You got to realize this is their game. And they have their think tanks. That's why anytime there's a problem here, they put a spin on it. Every time there's a problem. Cross Creek Lake got polluted. Well, first it was a collar leaked. Pipe leaked. Collar leaked. Then it was a vandal. It was vandalism. Somebody loosened three bolts on a collar. We did a file review at the DEP's office the same time we did mine on Cross Creek Park. There's absolutely nothing on there or in that file as far as a police report or anything stating vandalism. It's sickening already. It's got to stop. It has got to stop. And then the spin that the DEP and the industry puts on, acid mine drainage also. We've had acid mine drainage here forever. We never had these problems until they started drilling for the Marcellus Shale and are dumping all this polluted water. Again, Cross Creek Lake, you go back to Cross Creek Lake, how that got polluted. The stream that one of the streams, feeder streams that fed the lake, it killed all aquatic life in there. But they tell you they only use three chemicals that you could find on your spice rack. Okay, those are awfully powerful chemicals, or awfully powerful spices, if it kills all aquatic life. And they know some people are going to believe it. They know that.
if you could sit all these people in a room and really try to educate them and let them all view split estate and Dr. Theo Colborn and a lot of this other information that's out there and a lot of these other victims that are out there, then people would have a different attitude. Then I think their eyes would open and then they'd be a little scared. But I think now a lot of people around here are getting more scared because they're starting to find out that these water wells are contaminated because it's starting to leak out. Mm. But of course, the DEP and Range Resources and all the other companies around here, well, you got to prove it, you know. That's hearsay. You got to prove it, you know. You know how the game is played.
So yeah, and the state and the DEP says, "Oh, we monitor the river." It's 2 years in a row. The last 2 years that we've been told that our river's been polluted.
It's acid mine drainage.
Yeah, acid mine drainage. This acid water's been draining into the rivers since World War II, when they'd done all this strip mining here in World War II, you know, to get all the coal that they needed to run these steel mills and stuff.
It's like a cat and mouse game with them, is what it is. And again, they know they have all the money, they have all the political connections, so they're going to hang us out there to dry as best they can. And they're going to deny everything.
And what are we going to do about it?
Going to keep fighting.
The worst thing that ever happened to us was Bush and Cheney being in our politics, because they gave them all the rights in the world, Halliburton and all of them, on the drilling.
Well, they're oil men.
Yeah.
That's where they made their money, so naturally that's why they're doing what they're doing. That's why they did what they did, to take care of their boys. That's how it works.
They took care of Halliburton, and Halliburton's taking care of our lives.
Well, the future of the state is not bright. If they're going to continue doing what they're doing, how could it be bright? Again, I just have a 3-acre pond that got contaminated in 05, 06. Then you have the Mon River that's contaminated. Now the TDSs are up in the Allegheny River because they're dumping in the Allegheny River. I think there are three facilities that dump in the Allegheny side now. Then we had our beautiful park out here, Cross Creek, contaminated, a stream contaminated, and that stream feeds the lake. And individuals that I know that fish out there told me, and they fish out there on a regular basis, said that the fishing hasn't been the same. And then you had Brush Run Creek just a few weeks ago contaminated. And they only say, well, they killed some fish, killed some minnows. No, you're killing our whole ecosystem. It's just not fish. And up in Brook...
This is not a person.
So.
Yeah, and the state and the DEP says, oh, we monitor the river. It's 2 years in a row. The last 2 years that we've been told that our river's been polluted.
It's acid mine drainage.
Yeah, acid mine drainage. This acid water's been draining into the rivers since World War II, when they'd done all this strip mining here in World War II, you know, to get all the coal that they needed to run these steel mills and stuff.
It's like a cat and mouse game with them, is what it is. And again, they know they have all the money, they have all the political connections, so they're going to hang us out there to dry as best they can. And they're going to deny everything.
And what are we going to do about it?
Going to keep fighting.
The worst thing that ever happened to us was Bush and Cheney being in our politics, because they gave them all the rights in the world, Halliburton and all of them, on the drilling.
Well, they're oil men.
Yeah.
That's where they made their money, so naturally that's why they're doing what they're doing. That's why they did what they did, to take care of their boys. That's how it works.
They took care of Halliburton, and Halliburton's taking care of our lives.
Well, the future of the state is not bright. If they're going to continue doing what they're doing, how could it be bright? Again, I just have a 3-acre pond that got contaminated in 05, 06. Then you have the Mon River that's contaminated. Now the TDSs are up in the Allegheny River because they're dumping in the Allegheny River. I think there are three facilities that dump in the Allegheny side now. Then we had our beautiful park out here, Cross Creek, contaminated, a stream contaminated, and that stream feeds the lake. And individuals that I know that fish out there told me, and they fish out there on a regular basis, said that the fishing hasn't been the same. And then you had Brush Run Creek just a few weeks ago, contaminated. And they only say, well, they killed some fish, killed some minnows. No, you're killing our whole ecosystem. It's just not fish. And up in Clearfield County, Trout Run just was contaminated by a Marcellus shell site. And Trout Run is one of the top native brookie streams in Clearfield County, which I've fished many times. And the headwaters start at a campground in Sykesville. I think it's called Sykesville Camp. Well, every place they go, they're contaminating. And, you know, you can't keep... The excuses are gone. People, they're done with excuses. The majority of the people now know that these problems never occurred before until they started drilling. And come on, it's common sense. If you're going to be drilling using all the millions and millions of gallons of water and you're using chemicals and you got the backflow and they're pumping it back out, pumping it out of the frac tanks or frac pits and they're dumping it at supposedly treatment plants, et cetera, et cetera. And it's going back into the rivers, you know there are going to be problems. You can't take all those chemicals out. I mean, it's common sense what's happening. That's what kills me. It's common sense. So what are you doing for this state? You're doing nothing for this state other than endangering everybody involved in the whole ecosystem, period. And they're tearing up our natural forest. Where do people go to have picnics with their kids? Where do they go to ride their bikes? And you get to see all these tanks. And all the carcinogens and everything that's coming out that no one realizes what they're breeding. And you think you're having a good time and a safe time and a healthy time? And what is it doing to all the animals? Come on. We need science done here is what we need.
They're giving everything away to the gas companies. They're signing, our governor is signing anything that the gas companies want. They're going to let them tear our forest up. And contaminate the water in the forest up in the mountains. The mountain spring water is the best water in the country.
Right.
Yeah.
And well, they're going to go up there and contaminate it.
The only thing that the politicians and the DEP, the only thing that these folks are regulating are their pocketbooks.
Right.
That's what they're regulating.
And once they get their pocket full and the gas company does what they please, they'll move out of the state because they know it's contaminated. They'll move somewhere else because they got a pocket full of money. They can afford to go somewhere else.
That was Ron Gulla, a farmer in Hickory, Pennsylvania, joined by Emil Alexander.
The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe. The Red Death had long devastated the country. No pestilence had ever been so fatal or so hideous. Blood was its avatar, and its seal, the redness and the horror of blood. There were sharp pains and sudden dizziness, and then profuse bleeding at the pores with dissolution. The scarlet stains upon the body, and especially upon the face of the victim, were the pest ban which shut him out from the aid and from the sympathy of his fellow men. And the whole seizure, progress, and termination of the disease were the incidents of half an hour. But Prince Prospero was happy and dauntless and sagacious. When his dominions were half depopulated, he summoned to his presence 1,000 hale and light-hearted friends from among the knights and dames of his court, and with these retired into deep seclusion into one of his castellated abbeys. This was an extensive and magnificent structure, the creation of the prince's own eccentric yet august taste. A strong and lofty wall girdled it in. His wall had gates of iron. The courtiers, having entered, brought furnaces and massy hammers and wielded the bolts. They resolved to leave means neither of ingress or egress to the sudden impulses of despair or of frenzy from within. The abbey was amply provisioned. With such precautions, the courtiers might bid defiance to contagion. The external world could take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve or to think. The prince had provided all the appliances of pleasure. There were buffoons, there were improvisatori, there were ballet dancers, there were musicians, there was beauty, there was wine. All these and security were within. Without was the Red Death. It was towards the close of the fifth or sixth month of his seclusion, and while the pestilence raged most furiously abroad, that the Prince Prospero entertained his 1,000 friends at a masked ball of the most unusual magnificence. It was a voluptuous scene, that masquerade. But first let me tell of the rooms from which it was held. There were 7, an imperial suite. In many palaces, however, such suites form a long and straight vista, while the folding doors slide back nearly to the walls on either hand, so that the view of the whole extent is scarcely impeded. Here the case was very different, as might have been expected from the Duke's love of the bazaar. The apartments were so irregularly disposed that the vision embraced but little more than one at a time. There was a sharp turn at every 20 or 30 yards, and at each turn a novel effect. To the right and left, in the middle of each wall, a tall and narrow Gothic window looked out upon a closed corridor which pursued the windings of the suite. These windows were of stained glass, whose color varied in accordance with the prevailing hue of the decorations of which the chamber into which it opened. That at the eastern extremity was hung, for example, in blue, and vividly blue were its windows. The second chamber was purple in its ornaments and tapestries, and there the panes were purple. The third was green throughout, and so were the casements. The fourth was furnished and lighted with orange, the fifth with white, the sixth with violet. The seventh apartment was closely shrouded in black velvet tapestries that hung all over the ceiling and down the walls, falling in heavy folds upon a carpet of the same material and hue. But in this chamber only, the color of the windows failed to correspond with the decorations. The panes here were scarlet, a deep blood color. Now in no one of the 7 apartments was there any lamp or candelabrum. Amid the profusion of golden ornaments that lay scattered to and fro or depended from the roof, there was no light of any kind emanating from lamp or candle within the suite of chambers. But in the corridors that followed the suite there stood, opposite to each window, a heavy tripod bearing a brazier of fire that projected its rays through the tinted glass and so glaringly illuminated the room, and thus were produced a multitude of gaudy and fantastic appearances. But in the western or black chamber the effect of the firelight that streamed upon the dark hangings through the blood-tinted panes was ghastly in the extreme, and produced so wild a look upon the countenances of those who entered that there were few of the company bold enough to set foot within its precincts at all. It was in this apartment also that there stood against the western wall a gigantic clock of ebony. Its pendulum swung to and fro with a dull, heavy, monotonous clang. And when the minute had made the circuit of the face, and the hour was to be stricken, there came from the brazen lungs of the clock a sound which was clear and loud and deep and exceedingly musical, but of so peculiar a note and emphasis that, at each lapse of an hour, the musicians of the orchestra were constrained to pause momentarily in their performance, to hearken to the sound. And thus the waltzers perforce ceased their evolutions, and there was a brief disconcert of the whole gay company, and, while the chimes of the clock yet rang, it was observed that the giddiest grew pale, and the more aged and sedate passed their hands over their brows as if in confused reverie or meditation. But when the echoes had fully ceased, a light laughter at once pervaded the assembly. The musicians looked at each other and smiled as if at their own nervousness and folly, and made whispering vows each to the other that the next chiming of the clock should produce in them no similar emotion. And then, after the lapse of 60 minutes, which embraced 3,600 seconds of the time that flies, there came yet another chiming of the clock, and then with the same disconcert and tremulousness and meditation as before. But in spite of these things, it was a gay and magnificent revel. The tastes of the Duke were peculiar. He had a fine eye for colors and effects. He disregarded the decor of mere fashion. His plans were bold and fiery, and his conceptions glowed with barbaric luster. There are some who would have thought him mad. His followers felt that he was not. It was necessary to hear and see and touch him to be sure that he was not. He had directed in great part the movable embellishments of the 7 chambers upon occasion of this great fête, and it was his own guiding taste which had given character to the masqueraders. Be sure they were grotesque, There was such glare and glitter and piquancy and phantasm, much of what has been since seen in Hernani. There were arabesque figures with unsuited limbs and appointments. There were delirious fancies such as the madman fashions. There were much of the beautiful, much of the wanton, much of the bizarre, something of the terrible, and not a little of that which might have excited disgust. To and fro in the seven chambers was stalked, in fact, a multitude of dreams, and these, the dreams, writhed in and out, taking hue from the rooms, and causing the wild music of the orchestra to seem as the echo of their steps. And anon there strikes the ebony clock which stands in the hall of the velvet. And then for a moment all is still and all is silent save the voice of the clock. The dreams are stiff frozen as they stand, but the echoes of the chime die away. They have endured but an instant, and the light, half-subdued laughter floats after them as they depart. And now again the music swells, and the dreams live and writhe to and fro more merrily than ever, taking hue from the many tinted windows through which stream the rays from the tripods. But the chamber which lies most westwardly of the seven, there are now none of the maskers who venture, for the night is waning away, and there flows a ruddier light through the blood-colored panes, and the blackness of the sable drapery appalls, and to him whose foot falls upon the sable carpet, there comes from the near clock of ebony a muffled peal more solemnly emphatic than any which reaches their ears, who indulge in the most remote gaieties of the other apartments. But these other apartments were densely crowded, and in them beat feverishly the heart of life, and the revel went whirlingly on, until at length there commenced the sounding of midnight upon the clock. And then the music ceased, as I have told, and the evolutions of the waltzes were quieted, and there was an uneasy cessation of all things as before. But now there were 12 strokes to be sounded by the bell of the clock, and thus it happened, perhaps, that more of thought crept, with more of time, into the meditations of the thoughtful among those who reveled. And thus, too, it happened, perhaps, that before the last echoes of the last chime had utterly sunk into silence, there were many individuals in the crowd who had found leisure to become aware of the presence of a masked figure, which had arrested the attention of no single individual before. And the rumor of this new presence having spread itself whisperingly around, there rose at length from the whole company a buzz or murmur, expressive of disapprobation and surprise, and then finally of terror, of horror, and of disgust. In an assembly of phantasms such as I have painted, there may well be supposed that no ordinary appearance could have excited such sensation. In truth, the masquerade license of the night was nearly unlimited, but the figure in question had out-heroded Herod, and gone beyond the bounds of even the prince's indefinite decorum. There are chords in the hearts of the most reckless which cannot be touched without emotion, even to the utterly lost, to whom life and death were equally jests. There are matters of which no jest can be made. The whole company, indeed, seem now deeply to feel that in the costume and bearing of the stranger neither wit nor propriety existed. The figure was tall and gaunt and shrouded from head to foot in the habiliments of the grave. The mask which concealed the visage was made so nearly to resemble the countenance of a stiffened corpse that the closest scrutiny must have had difficulty in detecting the cheat. And yet all this might have been endured, if not proved, by the mad revelers around. But the mummer had gone so far as to assume the type of the Red Death. His vesture was dabbled in blood, and his broad brow, with all the features of a face, was besprinkled with the scarlet horror. When the eyes of the Prince Prospero fell upon the spectral image, which, with a slow and solemn movement, as if more fully to sustain his role, stalked to and fro among the waltzers, he was seen to be convulsed, in the first moment, with a strong shudder of either terror or distaste, but, in the next, his brow reddened with rage. "Who dares," he demanded hoarsely of the courtiers who stood near him, "who dares insult us with this blasphemous mockery? Seize him and unmask him, that we may know whom we have to hang at sunrise from the battlements." It was in the eastern or blue chamber in which stood the Prince Prospero as he uttered these words. They rang throughout the seven rooms loudly and clearly, for the prince was a bold and robust man, and the music had become hushed at the waving of his hand. It was in the blue room where stood the prince, with a group of pale courtiers by his side. At first, as he spoke, there was a slight rushing movement of this group in the direction of the intruder, who at the moment was also near at hand, and now, with deliberate and stately step, made closer approach to the speaker. But from a certain nameless awe with which the mad assumptions of the mummer had inspired the whole party, there were found none who put forth hands to seize him, so that, unimpeded, he passed within a yard of the prince's person. And while the vast assembly, as if with one impulse, shrank from the centres of the rooms to the walls, he made his way uninterruptedly, but with the same solemn and measured step which had distinguished him from the first, through the blue chamber to the purple, through the purple to the green to the orange, through this again to the white, and even thence to the violet, ere a decided movement had been made to arrest him. It was then, however, that the Prince Prospero, maddening with rage and the shame of his own momentary cowardice, rushed hurriedly through the six chambers, while none followed him on account of a deadly terror that had seized upon all. He bore aloft a drawn dagger and had approached, in rapid impetuosity, to within 3 or 4 feet of the retreating figure, when the latter, having attained the extremity of the velvet apartment, turned suddenly and confronted his pursuer. There was a sharp cry, and the dagger dropped gleaming upon the sable carpet, upon which instantly afterwards fell prostrate in death the Prince Prospero. Then, summoning the wild courage of despair, a throng of the revellers at once threw themselves into the black apartment, and, seizing the mummer, whose tall figure stood erect and motionless within the shadow of the ebony clock, gasped in unutterable horror at finding the grave cerements and corpse-like mask, which they handled with so violent a rudeness, untented by any tangible form. And now was acknowledged the presence of the Red Death. He had come like a thief in the night, and one by one dropped the revellers in the blood-bedewed halls of their revel, and died each in the despairing posture of his fall. And the life of the ebony clock went out with that of the last of the gay, and the flames of the tripods expired, and darkness and decay and the Red Death held illimitable dominion over all. The end of The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe.
Our next testimony comes from Terry Greenwood of Daisy Town, Pennsylvania, and was recorded in October by George Sapio and Morris Stevens. That will be followed by Lori from Geneva, New York, who spoke to Walter Hang of Toxics Targeting about what happened to her water supply.
We haven't drank our water here since January of 2008, so we're a little bit afraid to drink it. You know, after they ruined the other two water tables, we're just afraid to drink it anymore. And it got down to where the cattle are drinking out of a water buffalo now because they ruined the pond, they ruined the spring. They took our well water. Our well water got polluted, and they had to drill 5 wells to get another well water. But I don't even know. We don't even know if that's good. They said it's good, but I don't know if it is. All these water tables are coming up more and more bad, and they can't haul this water back to the sewage plants because the sewage plants won't take it because they can't get everything out of them. They can't process it right. Yeah. No, it's all that brines, they call it, that brines with the salt in it, and I don't know what else is in it. There's more stuff in it than what they're admitting to. Yeah. And like my wife said, she'd go to work in the morning, and this road down here would be soaking wet. She said, it didn't rain. Well, my brother's seen one of them guys hauling one of them trucks. He stopped them up in the mountains. He had the valve part ways open, and he was dumping it on the road, going down the road. And my brother says, you're leaking this stuff out on the road. He said, oh, no, somebody must have bumped that valve. He said, there ain't nothing in this thing. Yeah, that's how they get rid of it.
Water's more important than gas and this and that. You can heat with coal, you can heat with wood, but water's more important. Yeah.
Okay, and where do you live?
Geneva, New York.
Okay, and how long have you lived here?
A little over 3 years now.
And then what happened with the well on the adjoining property?
Well, they when they came, we signed the agreement, I think it was in February of 07. They didn't start drilling the well until the fall. And they were in touch with me, and I was in touch with them about the hydrofracking. And I asked them, I said, I'd like to have my water tested before you do the hydrofracking, and then after, so I can see if there's any problem with my drinking water. So they tested it beforehand, and then they let me know, you know, the day before, the day of, that they were going to be hydrofracking, because they said there'll be a lot of noise, there's going to be these big trucks out there. So they let me know when it would be. Well, I think it was the day after. I don't think it was the day of, but the day after that they were doing it, I went to my faucet and in the toilets, and the water was gray, cloudy, and had sediment in it. So I called them, and they said, well, it should clear up. So after 3 or 4 days, I was still having a problem. And so I said, you all need to do something about it because you agreed that my water would be potable. So I called Culligan and asked them what their recommendation would be. So they suggested that I put in a depth filter because the depth filter would filter out any of the sediment. So I contracted with Culligan to have it done, but I asked Chesapeake to pay for it. So they were willing to pay for it after, again, some negotiations, pay for that, and also for 5 months for me to rent the unit.
And did they dispute that it was a result of their hydrofracking operation that impacted your water?
Not at all.
And so they basically just owned up to it?
Yeah, because that was the only thing that had happened that would change my water instantly. So they recognized that hydrofracking can do that, and since I had that clause in, they were responsible to take care of it.
And you have a copy of the check that you received to reimburse you for these costs, correct?
Yes, I do.
And it says right on the check that it's for so-called, quote, damages.
That's correct. That's correct.
And have they in any way said to you, well, it's been widely reported that there's never been a single fracking problem anywhere in New York State?
They didn't say that to me, but I have heard that that is what they are telling the public. And I've actually been reading up about it, and there have been a lot of articles in the paper. So now the thing I'm concerned about, because I know that the hydrofracking affected my well, and I found out now that they use chemicals along with the water in the hydrofracking process. So now I'm concerned, because I just became aware of this in the past number of months, well, what chemicals could be in my water now that could have a long-term chronic effect on my health, my family, and I have no idea what they can be, and how do I test for them?
And you essentially contacted me, Walter Hang,
yes,
after you saw me on TV talking about this issue, and then you showed me the analytical results of your water testing, and now you've shown me your water filter. And the bottom line is they didn't test specifically for the wide array of chemicals,
correct,
that could be in your water. And so did you talk to Chesapeake about that concern?
Actually, I called them today because I said I had become aware of this problem. So I asked them, I said, well, on the water, he said, well, we did the water test that you requested. And I said, yes, but when I look at the water test, it's for very, very basic things, maybe 6 or 7 different things, including the pH of the water. So I said, how do I know that the chemicals that you use are not in my water? And he said, well, they are proprietary, and I can put you in touch with corporate headquarters, and maybe they can help you on that.
And then you went to look at their website for information about these fracking chemicals?
He told me that on the website, and I have not checked it out yet, I just spoke to him a little bit ago, that on the website you can go to a link that's called Frack Facts. And on there, there's a link that will tell you the chemicals, some of the chemicals that can be used in the hydrofracking. And he said that what it does is it shows that the chemicals are also chemicals that are found in everyday life and that they really have no major effect on anyone's health. He said that there have been a lot of scare tactics that have been used on the public recently about the possibility of the damaging chemicals in the water. And what he was saying, that this website just shows you that they really aren't harmful at all.
But you are still filtering your water.
Yes, absolutely.
And what is it that you now want from the state authorities who are in charge of safeguarding your property value and your health and making sure that these natural gas drilling activities are performed safely and properly?
Well, I want to know what's in my water, you know. So obviously, well, I assume that they use the chemical fracturing, and because it affected my well, it's going to affect the chemicals that are in my water now. So I want to know what they use, and I want them to test to see if they are in my water. And I also want to make sure that this isn't also happening to other people in the area, because people aren't aware of it. I've just become aware of it, and I don't think it's fair to the community that this is being done without their knowledge of the potential hazards.
And I had showed you a map of all of the gas wells in this area, didn't I?
Yeah, hundreds and hundreds.
And you pretty much didn't know that that was the situation when you moved here,
I had no idea. I had no idea.
So essentially, correct me if I'm wrong, but you want Governor Patterson and the Department of Environment and Conservation to make you and your family whole, to make sure that you're not having any health effects, and to make sure your property value is not impaired. And if there's a problem, to make sure that it is fully and completely cleaned up.
Absolutely. I mean, we bought this house in good faith when we moved here, knowing that we'd have an excellent resale value. And if we have a problem with our water being tainted with chemicals, and it's publicly known because when we sell our house, the lease has to be transferred with it. So people will know that we've signed a lease. They will, you know, people may know that this has been a major problem in this area. And who wants to buy a house and pay full price when you know that the water may be unacceptable? So I'm concerned about my property value, very much so.
Captain Murderer, an excerpt from The Uncommercial Traveler, Chapter 15, Nurse's Tales, by Charles Dickens. Read for LibriVox by Beth Peat at Reading, UK. The first diabolical character who intruded himself on my peaceful youth, as I called to mind that day at Dulborough, was a certain Captain Murderer. This wretch must have been an offshoot of the Bluebeard family, but I had no suspicion of the consanguinity in those times. His warning name would seem to have awakened no general prejudice against him, for he was admitted into the best society and possessed immense wealth. Captain Murderer's mission was matrimony and the gratification of a cannibal appetite with tender brides. On his marriage morning, he always caused both sides of the way to the church to be planted with curious flowers, and when his bride said, "Dear Captain Murderer, I never saw flowers like these before. What are they called?" he answered, "They are called garnish for house lamb," and laughed at his ferocious practical joke in a horrid manner, disquieting the minds of the noble bridal company with a very sharp row of teeth, then displayed for the first time. He made love in a coach and six, and married in a coach and 12, and all his horses were milk-white horses with one red spot on the back which he caused to be hidden by the harness. For the spot would come there, though every horse was milk-white when Captain Murderer bought him, and the spot was young bride's blood. To this terrific point I am indebted for my personal experience of a shudder and cold beads in the forehead. When Captain Murderer had made an end of feasting and revelry, and had dismissed the noble guests, and was alone with his wife on the day of the month after their marriage, it was his whimsical custom to produce a golden rolling pin and a silver pie-board. Now there was a special feature in the captain's courtships that he always asked if the young lady could make pie crust, and if she couldn't by nature or education, she was taught. Well, when the bride saw Captain Murderer produce the golden rolling pin and silver pie-board, she remembered this, and turned up her laced silk sleeves to make a pie. The captain brought out a silver pie dish of immense capacity, and the captain brought out flour and butter and eggs and all things needful, except the inside of the pie. Of the materials for the staple of the pie itself, the captain brought out none. Then said the lovely bride, "Dear Captain Murderer, what pie is this to be?" He replied, "A meat pie." Then said the lovely bride, "Dear Captain Murderer, I see no meat." The captain humorously retorted, "Look in the glass." She looked in the glass, but still she saw no meat. And then the captain roared with laughter, and suddenly frowning and drawing his sword, bade her roll out the crust. So she rolled out the crust, dropping large tears upon it all the time because he was so cross. And when she had lined the dish with the crust, and had cut the crust all ready to fit the top, the captain called out, "I see meat in the glass." And the bride looked up at the glass, just in time to see the captain cutting her head off. And he chopped her in pieces, and peppered her, and salted her, and put her in the pie, and sent it to the baker's, and ate it all, and picked the bones. Captain Murderer went on in this way, prospering exceedingly, until he came to choose a bride from two twin sisters, and at first didn't know which to choose. For though the one was fair and the other dark, they were both equally beautiful. But the fair twin loved him, and the dark twin hated him, so he chose the fair one. The dark twin would have prevented the marriage if she could, but she couldn't. However, on the night before it, much suspecting Captain Murderer, she stole out and climbed his garden wall, and looked in at his window through a chink in the shutter, and saw him having his teeth filed sharp. Next day she listened all day, and heard him make his joke about the house lamb. And that day month he had the paste rolled out, cut the fair twin's head off, and chopped her in pieces, and peppered her, and salted her, and put her in the pie, and sent it to the baker's, and ate it all, and picked the bones. Now, the dark twin had had her suspicions much increased by the filing of the captain's teeth, and again by the house lamb joke. Putting all things together when he gave out that her sister was dead, she divined the truth, and determined to be revenged. So she went up to Captain Murderer's house, and knocked at the knocker, and pulled at the bell, and when the captain came to the door, said, "Dear Captain Murderer, marry me next, for I have always loved you and was jealous of my sister." The captain took it as a compliment, and made a polite answer, and the marriage was quickly arranged. On the night before it, the bride again climbed to his window, and again saw him having his teeth filed sharp. At this sight she laughed such a terrible laugh at the chink in the shutter, that the captain's blood curdled, and he said, "I hope nothing has disagreed with me." At that she laughed again, a still more terrible laugh, and the shutter was opened and a search made, but she was nimbly gone, and there was no one. Next day they went to church in a coach and twelve, and were married. And that day month she rolled the pie crust out, and Captain Murderer cut her head off, and chopped her in pieces, and peppered her, and salted her, and put her in a pie, and sent it to the baker's, ate it all, and picked the bones. But before she began to roll out the paste, she had taken a deadly poison of the most awful character, distilled from toad's eyes and spider's knees, and Captain Murderer had hardly picked her last bone, when he began to swell, and to turn blue, and to be all over spots, and to scream. And he went on swelling and turning bluer, and being more all over spots and screaming, until he reached from floor to ceiling and from wall to wall. And then, at 1 o'clock in the morning, he blew up with a loud explosion. At the sound of it, the milk-white horses in the stables broke their halters and went mad. And then they galloped over everybody in Captain Murderer's house, beginning with the family blacksmith who had filed his teeth, until the whole were dead. And then they galloped away. End of Captain Murderer by Charles Dickens.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN, Nashville, WUOW, Oneonta, KRBS, Oroville, WKNH, Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren.